We are back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula. Bill Russell and I are with the Danish physicist, Per Bach. So why do you do these things to yourself, Professor Bach?
Curiosity. That's the only reason for doing science. That I really would like to understand the dynamics of large, complex systems, what happens. And it's sort of quite obvious why that is, because as a physicist, I have been used to study things in the tiniest detail. The old-fashioned view of physics was that once you split it up into the tiniest parts, then we understand everything. Once you understand the atoms and how the atoms consist of electrons and neutrons and protons and so on, and once you figure out that these particles consist of quarks and gluons and whatever, and that those can be understood from string theory or whatever, then we're done. That's the traditional view.
And that's known as reductionist, yes?
Reductionism, I would say. And everything else is just putting everything together like Lego blocks or something. That there's nothing interesting in that. That's the traditional view. But looking around me, I feel we are not done once we have discovered all the particles and so on. Because if I look around me, I see you, I see life, I see economics, I see history, I see something that has nothing to do with that, with particles and quarks and gluons and protons and so on. And how does that come about? It's a fantastic question. How can you start with quarks and gluons and get humans and astrophysics and earthquakes and so on?
How can you? What's the answer to your question?
Well, that is what I told you before. That is what I would like to know. That's what I'm studying, and I'm only looking at a little part of it to see how I can get from a grain of sand to avalanches and so on. But that's only part of the great and general question as to how that happens.
Well, you started out talking about history and the contingency of history.
Yes.
And in a historical sense, we, you know, with Newton, we got classical mm-hmm. physics. With Einstein, we got general relativity,
yes.
special relativity, general
yes.
relativity.
Yes.
With a variety of people, I don't know who should get all the credit or most of the credit, we got the quantum universe. Mm-hmm. And what you're describing is something different. It sounds as if it is different from those what we consider the traditional historical development
yes.
of physics.
It's a very different way of thinking about it, because we used to think about things being predictable and following in a simple way the laws of physics, and we can sit down with pen and paper and describe it. So how come that suddenly, for phenomena that are also composed of quarks and gluons and string, eventually we have to use a different language, namely the language of history? Isn't that strange?
Which is narrative.
The reason we use the narrative rather than predicting is precisely because we cannot calculate and predict things. We can only, in hindsight, see what happens and identify individual events and so on, but we could not predict it. And therefore we go from describing the same universe, first in the laws of physics and determinism and so on, in the spirit of Newton and Einstein and so on. Eventually, we have to use a different language, namely that of history, to describe the same phenomena.
Are you then suggesting that some of the job of science is to put forth a variety of stories from which to pick?
No, not at all. That is for historians to come up with the actual history and for, others to try to predict the futures. There are people who do that too. So.
Usually badly.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense, you say, you know, you do this because it's interesting, because it's a challenge, and
yes.
what you're looking for is understanding. You've been doing this a long time. Do you have a sense of what that understanding would look like? Not what it is, but, you know, what form it would take? You know, is it mathematics? Is it statistical laws? What have you got?
It is mathematics and statistical laws, but I don't know. There we come back again to this, where we talk about for the adjacent possible. I cannot imagine what will happen.
Tell me about the adjacent possible.
Adjacent possible is simply the observation that there are so many possibilities in the universe, so many things that could happen, that the phase space is so enormous and we have chosen only one single trajectory in that space, and we can only imagine what is nearby. So therefore, it always seems that science is at an end or something, because we cannot even imagine what comes next. It's only in hindsight we can see that science was not at an end.
I want to put this in terms that I think most of us can relate to. Sitting where I am now, I have an adjacent possible. I could pick up a microphone and hit you over the head with it. Mm-hmm. That is an adjacent possibility. Your reaction to that is another step beyond that. Mm-hmm. And I can't predict how you would respond to me. I got a statistical sense of how you would respond.
I would put all of that into the adjacent possible because it's something that at least is within what you can think of.
So you're saying I can't even imagine out there.
You cannot even imagine.
This is radical. Yeah. A radical discrepancy between where we are and yes. some other place.
This seems to me to be awesomely hopeful that there is all of this that's there for us.
I don't know whether it's there for us because it just didn't happen. So it is not there for us. Only the adjacent possible is there for us.
Is that at that critical state as well?
I don't know.
Well, and the for us is a presumption. There are lots of other we co-occupy this space with all these other entities that you have described, and there's nothing in what you've said that suggests that somebody's engineered this, and it's precisely what you're saying is not mm-hmm. the case, that it has not been engineered for our well-being.
No.
We could step off into a cataclysmic event.
One accident after another. Throughout evolution.
Please go back to this notion of co-evolving, because I think that's part of what Bill is talking about, if I understand you correctly, that because things affect each other and there's no way...
One cannot think about biology in terms of an old-fashioned way where the single species compete in a rigid environment. We all evolve together as an ecology.
That changes everything,
that
doesn't it?
That changes everything. And we change all the time. That's another thing. One more issue I'd like to talk a little about, and that is, again, the stability of nature. That we hear that some people set up as a goal that we should have a sustainable system. That would be very nice, but that's just not possible. We always affect our environment, and we affect other species and so on. And we can never go back to where we were. We always go into a new situation, a new state. So it's an illusion that we can have a sustainable future where everybody will live happily ever after. Maybe we will live happily ever after anyhow, but it would not be in an environment like what we see now.
And what I think we're think of when we say sustainable is a steady state,
yes,
continuous flow where all the creatures that are continue to be and all the ones that aren't don't, and that's...
It never happened before because it was different before. There were dinosaurs at some point and they disappeared. I don't think that this is...
The engineering argument is that because we can manipulate little pieces of nature that we can somehow or other substantially influence that. And I think that's part of the underlying perspective. And what you're saying is that's an illusion.
I think it's an illusion, personally, because we do affect, we do deplete resources or change resources by our existence here. And I don't see anything different now from what the way it was before, that things are changing all the time. And I think that eventually we will be able to confront these situations. We should not try to optimize and predict, but try to adapt to whatever happens. That's a much better strategy. Put us in a position where we can adapt to global warming if it happens, instead of trying desperately to prevent it, which we probably cannot do anyhow. Or maybe it will not happen no matter what we are doing. But the best we can do is to put ourselves in a situation where we can adapt to whatever happens.
Self-organized criticality sounds a lot like what we used to think of as the law of unintended consequences. Now, I don't mean that in a reductionist sense, but just as a sort of a hand wave, get your hand around it.
In science, we don't talk about intentions. Just describe the world as we see it. Whether these consequences are intended or not intended, that's
beside the point.
Not of our concern.
Our scientist is Per Bock. We're going to be back with him for a couple of more minutes when we return with the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I invite you to be with us when we return.